The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support from Carl and Pat Keppen, and we thank them for their continued support. We are reading today from the combined issues for November and December 2022. The Ultimate Craftsman, Antonio Stradivari, still reigns supreme after more than 300 years. More than 4,500 years after an enterprising Mesopotamian stretched a few cords of catgut over a hollow wooden vessel to create the first lute, the craft of building string instruments reached a state of near perfection in a humble workshop in Cremona, Italy. The craftsman name is still known around the world more than 300 years later, though his life story remains something of a mystery. Antonio Stradivari, maker of incomparable violins, cellos, and more. Among the violin virtuosos who play a Stradivarius still today are Itzhak Perlman, Akiko Suwanee, and Joshua Bell. I still can't think of anything else that has been frozen in time and stands as the holy grail for modern use, says Gary Strum, curator emeritus at the National Museum of American History's Division of Musical History. It's generally agreed that Stradivari was born in Cremona around 1644 and that he began his career around the age of 12. He was long believed to have apprenticed with the famous Amati family, though recent scholarship finds little evidence for this account. Regardless, the Amati designs were the ones to beat, and Stradivari spent nearly 70 years doing just that, creating a prodigious number of instruments, 1,200 or so in all, of which some 500 violins, 55 cellos, and a dozen violas survive today. Stradivari began selling instruments around 1665, building his business steadily until Niccolò Amati, the last great artisan in that family, died in 1684, leaving an opening in the growing market for Cremonese violins. Stradivari's instruments became so coveted that he received commissions from the likes of the Medicis and King James II of England. He married twice and worked out of his house, and unlike other luthiers in this city of musical innovation, he was notable for never using apprentices, teaching his craft only to two of his sons. This old bull Stradivarius made in 1687 is one of five Strads in the Smithsonian collections. And there's a picture of it here on the cover story. It takes its name from its most illustrious owner, Ola Bornemann Bull, a 19th century Norwegian concertmaster whom Robert Schumann called the equal of Paganini. It is one of only 10 or 11 decorated violins that survive from Stradivari's shop. The inlaid and painted design along the front edges offer a gently mesmerizing geometry, and the sides are decorated with painted foliage. The sound is sweet and flexible, according to Ken Sloak, the curator of musical instruments at the National Museum of American History. The violin, which came to the Smithsonian on loan in the mid-1980s and entered the permanent collection in 2000, represents a big step forward in Stradivari's search for a more powerful concert instrument, says Rainer Cochran, a violin expert at Ingalls and Hayday, a rare instrument auction house. There's a long-standing theory that Europe's little ice age, which lasted from the 14th century until around 1850, is what made Stradivari's creation special. As the theory goes, slower tree growth created denser woods with narrower grains that conveyed a richer sound. But Stuart Pollins, former conservator of musical instruments at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York and author of two books about Stradivari, says, "I'm not a big believer in the little ice age business, mainly because when you inspect Stradivari's wood today, you'll find all manner of different densities. Sometimes the grain is quite broad, and sometimes it's very narrow." Scholars have argued that the secret might be in Stradivari's mode of treating his wood, including his varnishes. This line of thought was energized by a 2006 study in Nature by Joseph Nagavari, professor emeritus of biochemistry at Texas A&M University. Using nuclear magnetic resonance and infrared spectrography, Nagavari found that metallic salts may have played a role in these instruments' nuanced tones. Another study released last year bolsters the idea that varnishes and oils contributed to the Stradivarius magic. Pollins and Cochran say the truest explanation is the simplest. Stravardi was a fastidious craftsman who undertook small experiments with geometry and wood thickness, perfecting flatter arching on the front and back to create violins with much more power than any before. Indeed, Stradivari's instruments made it possible for the music to reach every corner of large concert halls, and thereby helped usher in the symphonic age of Mozart, Beethoven, and Tchaikovsky. Stradivari anticipated the growing role of the violin as a solo instrument and brought violin making to new heights, says Cochran, who marvels at how attuned Stradivari was to musical trends. By the same time Stradivari died in 1737, his skill and foresight had made him a rich man. His instruments are still valuable commodities. In June, a 1714 Strad sold for $15 million, and today's top players are still drawn to them. "There's a bottomlessness to the possibilities," says renowned cellist Evan Drachman, who played his first Stradivarius cello at 18 and whose grandfather was the celebrated Ukrainian-born cellist Gregor Piotrogorsky. James Innes, a violin soloist who serves as artistic director of the Seattle Chamber Music Society and visiting professor at the Royal Academy of Music in England, estimates he has played more than 150 Strads. He describes the experience as cinematic epiphany. "It really was a bit like the Wizard of Oz, everything being in black and white, and then in color." And that was The Ultimate Craftsman by Claire Rosen. The next article is "The Blue That Enchanted the World." Indigo is growing again in South Carolina, revived by artisans and farmers with a modern take on a forgotten history. On John's Island in South Carolina, tucked along Maybank Highway, not far from where the Stono River meets Penny's Creek, sits a long-obscured piece of history. The remains of a four-chambered brick structure are set among the black gum trees, live oaks, and scrub brush. As at its base, partially covered by moss and bald cypress roots, the tint that enchanted the colonial world is still visible. The ridges of the mortar between the bricks emit a blue hue, the color of the ocean. Indigo, a name that refers to the shrub, the dye, the plant that produces, and the color itself. The crumbling vat, with squares aligned back to back, was built to process the plant when the demand for indigo dye was at its height. For 50 years, starting in the late 1740s, indigo was a major South Carolina cash crop, second only to rice. At one time, the extracted pigment dried and shaped into circular cakes, so was prized that it was sometimes called blue gold and used as currency, even as barter for slaves. After the Revolutionary War, indigo processing fell into obscurity, relegated to the fringes of the agricultural conversation, if it was ever mentioned at all, as a historical oddity. In recent years, as demand for housing on John's Island has led to the excavation of previously fallow land, more of these brick vats are being uncovered, giving archaeologists and historians rare insight into the time when the state was a British colony. Today's farmers, textile dyers, and fabric artists in the region are championing indigo as a sustainable, regenerative alternative to modern-day petroleum-based dyes. As more residents learn about indigo's former prominence, they are beginning to cultivate the plant and experiment with its many uses. With the crop's resurgence, the Lowcountry is in the midst of an unexpected blue-hued revival. Wearing a wraparound dress the color of the morning sky and shod in rain boots, textile artist-turned-indigo farmer Lee Magar squelches through the wet, muddy, pulpy mess that heavy machinery has made of the terrain. She has heard that indigo vats built in the 1740s sit on land that is scheduled to become a housing development, and she wants to see for herself whether the remnants for which she has such reverence are still intact. The second growth forest that once hid the vats has been ripped out and ground down. Where developers see the trees as obstacles, Magar sees opportunity. To create a yellow pigment, she uses bark and pulp from oak trees. Look at all this potential dye. It's good material wasted, Magar says, standing atop a pile of mulch that used to be foliage. In addition to the indigo she grows on her property, Magar gathers wild indigo for what she calls seed-to-stitch artistry. The concept is similar to farm-to-table dining. As her way of paying homage to the history of the crop, her work involves growing the plant, processing it into dye, and then coloring her chosen material with it. After that, she begins to create. Magar makes everything from dresses to pocket squares. A lifelong South Carolinian, Magar has always had a connection to the land and the state's textile history. The women in her family worked in the cotton mills. She attempted to get away from the long shadow that the physical labor of cotton casts, and for nearly two decades, she worked at a milliner owned by Magar Hatworks in Charleston, where she created finery for high-end retailers and customers. Over time, Magar became enchanted with the indigo color, but it wasn't until she closed her shop and moved out to John's Island with her partner that she understood the plant's importance in the region. With seeds she received from a hermit monk, she grew her first indigo crop in 2015. In her field, not far from her house, the mid-morning July air is already filled with gnats. Throngs of mosquitoes buzz around Magar and her apprentice, too. They don big straw hats to shield themselves from the worst of the heat, but the humidity is still smothering. Their indigo grows in two 150-foot-long rows perpendicular to the island's main road. This is their weekly picking session, and the two use sharp scissors to clip the plant's branches until they fill two tubs. Magar only plucks the amount she needs for the week, careful to catch as much of the growth as she can before the plant begins to bloom. Once the buds flower, the plant's energy is directed toward seed making, and the pigment in the leaves becomes less potent. Over the years, she has experimented with different growing and dyeing techniques. You work with your hands every day, Magar says. You're out there in the soil and the earth with a plant, nurturing it. It becomes so much more than a plant. In some ways, cultivating indigo is her attempt to preserve and pass on what she can of this landscape. Doing so in a traditional way, slowly and methodically, without machinery, honors the enslaved laborers responsible for indigo production three centuries ago. I feel like it's my calling, she explains. I just felt deep inside that in order to continue with my indigo work, I had to face the truth of history, which has inspired me to learn, read, and research. Portuguese records from after their arrival to West Africa in 1342, before the establishment of the transatlantic slave trade, detail West Africa's textile production, fabric, dyeing, and cloth trade. Hundreds of years later, when people from that region were stolen from their homeland and enslaved, they carried the knowledge of indigo cultivation to the United States, where the native Indigofera colinera, Indigofera lespocepla, thrived. That was a mouthful. Commercial success of the indigo crop in South Carolina is often credited to Eliza Lucas Pinckney, who was 18 years old in 1740, when she instructed enslaved people on one of her family's plantations outside of Charleston to experiment with seeds sent by her father, then the governor of Antigua, one of Britain's sugar colonies in the West Indies. The seeds came from the Caribbean or West Indian variety, Indigofera suffragosa. It was on the family's Wapu plantation that young Eliza Lucas, the enslaved laborers, and neighboring peers experimented with and developed the cultivation of the Caribbean strain of indigo, which produced more dye and became the preferred plant for production. With her indigo crop as dowry, she married Charles Pinckney, and they shared their seeds with other plantation owners. Production skyrocketed. As in the French and Spanish colonies, profits from the labor-intensive indigo production hinged on imported and enslaved Africans, referred to as black ivory, whose labor and often prior knowledge of indigo was exploited. The enterprise, from planting seeds to packing finished cakes of dye and occasionally transforming the color of cloth from brown to white to brilliant blue, would be the charge, who are usually absent from the history books. By 1775, South Carolina was exporting more than 1 million pounds of indigo annually. Historians now understand that the prosperity that indigo created was bought on the backs of slave labor, even as white Low Country elites took credit for and profited from the success. In the book Red, White, and Black Make Blue, Indigo in the Fabric of Colonial South Carolina Life, historian Andrea Fesser writes, indigo ignited the curiosity and interest of those who loved and studied plants. allowing them to accrue intellectual as well as monetary capital, yet contributed to the alienation of natives from their land. The shrub enriched many lives, but simultaneously impoverished others. Under the duress of torture, enslaved people provided the knowledge, labor, precision, and endurance that made the Low Country rich, but cost many of those their lives. I have to face this pain of South Carolina, McGar adds. I can't continue to work with it and deny that pain, especially as a white woman. McGar and her apprentice return to her artist studio, located in the back of her house, about a mile from the field. Bins of indigo in tow, the two pull up chairs and start stripping the leaves from the stems. Once they have enough, the transformation process begins. Magar loads the leaves into a large wooden mortar. Two handfuls are enough to fill the vessel, and then she takes the pestle and pounds, mashing the plant's leaves until they're blue-green sludge. Once it is almost liquid, the pair rolls the material into half-dollar-sized patties, smaller than the historical indigo cakes, which evenly space them on a platter and leave them to dry in the sun. After the Revolutionary War, the South Carolina Low Country, at the forefront of many of the conflicts between British loyalists and American patriots, was left in ruins. Indigo fields lay fallow. For 300 years, indigo barely survived, being cultivated in meager quantities by small numbers of planters and artists. Beginning in 1880, the popular blue hue could be simulated with petroleum-based synthetic dyes, which also were simpler, easier, and more efficient to work with, and obviated the need for a large labor force. Yet some never stopped planting indigo, for Sheena Myers, who grows her indigo on a half-acre plot in Adams Run, South Carolina, cultivating and harvesting it is a tradition. She remembers when her grandparents nurtured the crop as well as other plants from bygone times. Now, she's an energetic advocate of indigo and enjoys recommending it to the seemingly increasing number of young people seeking a craft that gets them back to the land. Consumer concerns about the impact of modern petroleum-based dyes on the communities tasked with making clothes and the industry's impact on climate are also spurring the indigo revival. The history behind the crop is so I can't put it into words. A lot of people don't even realize that it's an African American crop and how important it was to the slaves. Nobody talks about it anymore. Nobody grows it anymore. A lot of people think it's just ink, Meyer says. If you want to get into your history and be hands-on with it, I feel like indigo is the best way to go because a lot of the colorful dyes we have now are man-made, not derived from plants. Meyer's crop this year is tall and robust. The average height of each shrub now that they have been harvested and strung up to dry is about 5 feet. She uses extra extraction technique in which the sun-dried branches of the plant are covered in water. Boiling the water and adding salt speeds up the process until they emit color. At times, growers have more indigo than they can handle, and they pass a bit of the plant on to their peers. This is the way indigo spreads. Seeds passed from hand to hand, making their way up and down the South Carolina coast. Not every farmer has the same cultivation experience, and not every producer is interested in indigo's blue dye. A little farther upland and inland in Cross, South Carolina, Joy Mills had a more challenging journey with the plant. When I first started doing Indigo, it was hard as heck, she admits. Several of her early attempts at plant germination failed. I'm not going to lie to you. It was like me trying to figure out how to start an onion seed. Indigo and onion progeny are tiny, about the size of a pinhead. It's common to soak seeds in water before planting, and many practice scarification, damaging the seed coat so that the water better penetrates it. But that didn't work well for Mills, an herbologist, who is interested in the potential healing properties of indigo. A counter inside her home is covered with tinctures, infused honeys, and oils. Her five-acre property, dotted with potted plants. At the very front, she has a 10-foot-tall Confederate rosebush, Hibiscus mutabilis, a perennial shrub cultivated for its showy blooms. Parts of the plant can be used as an expectorant, and the leaves were once used for treating tuberculosis. Nepeta catateria, commonly known as catnip, can be brewed into a tea that is said to soothe muscle pains in the intestinal tract. She considers indigo, which is being studied as a treatment for types of psoriasis and peptic ulcers, essential to her medicinal arsenal. The roots and stems are reportedly used to clear congestion when experiencing a cold, bronchitis, or asthma. It is sometimes used to treat insect bites and skin disorders. When people learn alternative uses for indigo and reconnect with the land, appreciation for the plant will only increase, Mills says. Inspired by nature, artists turn to farmers, work in their little pockets of the Lowcountry as part of a new artisanal movement experimenting with, investigating, and appreciating the potential of indigo. Their modern labor means that South Carolina's past contributions to the global economy during the 18th century can be fully acknowledged and understood. Their work makes them part of an informal indigo network that now stretches out of the Lowcountry to places like Mississippi, which is also experimenting with a crop. Indigo's journey from West Africa to Charleston is integral to the understanding of its importance locally and globally to those who treasured it as well as those who toiled for it. Today's growers and creators are finding new ways to tell an almost forgotten story, and they are leaving an indelible mark on the Lowcountry landscape. The Blue That Enchanted the World, and that was written by Latria Graham. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Please call us with any questions at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.